Hello and welcome to another edition of Digital Flotsam. I'm P.W. Fenton. This installment is mainly about a terrifying personal experience. But I think that hidden in this tale is a feeling that I may have somehow brought it upon myself and my wife, Roz, by jinxing us with some offhanded remarks. So I'll call this installment the Superstitious Edition. It was Sunday, July 12, 1992, and it began like any other summer day on the Gulf Coast of Florida. It was in the mid-70s around daybreak, as the temperature began its normal climb towards 90. As frequent weekend sailors, my wife and I learned long ago that we had to get to the ramp at the mouth of the Anclote River in Tarpon Springs very early if we were going to grab a place to park our trailer. The ramp is so popular there that there can be many empty slots when you enter the small park that are full by the time you rig your sailboat and get into the water. All those powerboaters have to do is drop the boat in the water and park. We sailors have to spend a while raising the mast and fastening all the rigging. But being veterans of this sort of thing, my wife and I had the process of rigging our Compact 16 named the Sloop du Jour down to about 15 minutes. As was often the case, someone would stop by and watch the process. Some people would comment on how cute our little boat was. Some would compliment the clever name we had given it. Others would express a desire to take up sailing and then ask us questions about the boat. Today was no different. As we went through our rigging routine, we were approached by a middle-aged couple, new to the area and new to the idea of small boat sailing. We answered all their questions. How do you like the boat? Is it easy to sail? What does it weigh? What does a boat like that cost? Then the gentleman asked a question that was only significant to us many hours later. He said, "We've always loved the idea of sailing, but we're a little nervous about it. Aren't you afraid of a gust of wind capsizing you?" I smiled. "No, not really," I said. "It's really pretty easy to avoid that." And then I said something that would come back to haunt me many hours later. "Besides, you can't really capsize this boat. The whole boat weighs about 1,100 pounds, and the stout little keel on the bottom of the boat accounts for almost half of that weight. So even if it blew completely over, it would have to come right back up. It has no choice in the matter." The statement made sense to them, and it made sense to me. In fact, it still makes sense to me. Later in the day, though, I would learn that some things happen that don't make any sense. Soon we were on the water. Summertime sailing in Florida usually goes like this. Dead calm in the early morning, so you motor out. Around noon, if you're lucky, onshore breezes begin, but barely strong enough to keep your sails full. Around 3 or 4 p.m. and the winds begin to get strong enough, but you need to head for port because the reason the wind is picking up has to do with the huge cumulus clouds that are boiling upward that will around 5 p.m., turn into nasty thunderstorms. It's a cycle that repeats over and over until around October, when the really good sailing weather begins. We were ready for a typical summer day sailing. We motored with our little 5-horse Evinrude out the channel towards Anclote Key for about 2.5 miles and then turned north for about 4 miles to visit a favorite snorkeling spot. A submerged sandbar just north of the island with depths ranging from around 4 feet to as shallow as 1 foot. It was a great spot to anchor and snorkel. The sandy bottom was littered with sand dollars and tropical shells of all kinds. Occasionally, you could find yourself surrounded by a whole school of spotted eagle rays. I speak of this place in the past tense because it no longer exists. The tidal forces at work there continued until today, when that shallow area is now a sizable barrier island, popular with weekend boaters for picnicking and camping. We finished a lovely snorkel, climbed back into the boat, and broke out the drinks and sandwiches. It was about noontime. As I ate my sandwich, I couldn't help noticing that well to our south, around Clearwater, a good 10 miles south of us, the sky was darkening. It was rather unusual. It rarely gets stormy that early in the day this time of year. I didn't pay much mind to it until I glanced that way again and saw that it had turned seriously black and seemed to look closer. I wasn't sure that was true, but it was impressive enough that it at least felt closer. I told my wife that I was going to start heading back, and I started the motor. Now, normally, that would have produced an argument. I'm always the cautious one with my eye on the sky, and my wife is always the one who says, "Oh, come on, it's still nice out. Can't we stay a little longer?" Today, without hesitation, she said, "Okay." It only took a mile or so of motoring at a blazing top speed of 5 knots to realize that the black sky was indeed coming our way, and very quickly. It was clear to me that it was going to be upon us in just a few minutes. We would not have time to get anywhere near the boat ramp, even if we took a dangerous shortcut through shallow water. So at about a half mile east of the northern tip of Anclote Key, in about 8 feet of water, we dropped anchor. We let out almost all of our anchor load and began tying everything down in preparation for riding out the thunderstorm. We had been through this a few times before. The lightning and thunder was scary, but overall we felt rather safe inside the sloop du jour. In fact, we once even rescued another sailboat captain who had been thrown from his capsized sailboat in a raging thunderstorm. As we climbed into the cuddy cabin and closed the companionway hatch, I'd say we were mildly alarmed. But as the wind began to howl and pitch us around, I could see by my wife's wide eyes and labored breath that she was getting really scared. I tried to calm her. It wasn't working. I tried acting annoyed at her unnecessary alarm. That didn't work either. The wind was getting incredibly strong. I could feel the boat being blown around at the end of the anchor line. I could also hear that the mainsail was beginning to flap, despite our having tied it up carefully. I opened the hatch over my head. We were really in it now. The wind was so strong that the little bit of exposed sail was grabbing enough wind that it was being pulled up the mast. It had already pulled about 4 feet of sail out of the lashings. I knew I couldn't allow that to happen, so I grabbed 2 hands full of sailcloth and pulled it down into the cabin with me. That seemed to be working. It stopped climbing the mast. But I was being rained on really hard. I glanced over at Roz, who was by now holding the sides of the cabin as if to keep them from closing in. She was breathing so hard I was afraid she was going to pass out. I yelled something to that effect over the din of the raging wind. My attention was beginning to narrow. I could concentrate on only one thing, but no more than that. It was that tunnel vision effect that fear and panic bring on. I looked up through the hatch and saw the 22-foot aluminum mast literally whipping around as if it were made of rubber and not aluminum, and as if it had no stainless steel shrouds and stays attached to it. I don't know if I can convey those next few moments in words that can do the experience justice. When I think about them, they are unbelievable. They are impossible. They defy reason. As I watched my rubber mast whipping and snapping around before my eyes, I am awestruck. I can't take my eyes off of it. Then all of a sudden, I realize I am looking at something that makes even less sense than a rubber mast. Out beyond the end of the mast, which remember is 22 feet long, I am seeing the surface of the water. The first sense I can make of this, and I must have formed this opinion in a fraction of a second, was that a 50-foot wave was curling over the top of the mast. In reality, what seems to have happened would have made even less sense to me. I was apparently looking straight down past the end of the mast into the Gulf of Mexico roiling below. That's right, we were apparently upside down and in the air. Wham! The water hit us like a ton of bricks. Water rushed in the cabin from two directions at once, filling the boat in just a couple of seconds. The one thing we forgot to secure was a rear hatch cover that makes a center aft seat in the cockpit, and open allows for some convenient storage. What happened in those few seconds was very, very strange. I'm sure you would imagine incredible panic and a desperate scramble to find air to breathe. None of that was true. Instead, a feeling of calm came over me.
Was tossed. If not for the courage of the fearless crew, the minnow would be lost. The minnow would be lost. The ship set ground on shore of this uncharted desert isle, with Gilligan, the skipper too, the millionaire and his wife, the movie star, the professor and Mary Ann, here on Gilligan.
I felt no urge to breathe, even though I hadn't taken the time to take a deep breath in preparation for being submerged. My eyes were open, and I could see quite clearly, despite the fact that I was underwater and the boat was upside down in the middle of a storm that was as black as night. Roz later reported the exact same sensations. It was as if there was no longer anything to be afraid of. Everything you were afraid of had already happened, and you were okay. I reached over and removed the companionway hatch. I watched it float up and away. I was quiet. I swam out of the companionway and up around the side of the boat. As my head broke the surface, it was instantly apparent that the storm was not over. The wind was howling, and the rain and sea spray was being driven horizontally. There was so much water in the air, it was hard to breathe. I also noticed that the bottom of the boat was amazingly smooth and free of handholds. At that moment, my boast at the ramp about how this boat could not remain upside down did not occur to me. It was upside down, and it was staying that way. Then a rather important thought crossed my mind. Where was my wife? I instantly took a deep breath and did a duck dive to go and look for her. I almost collided with her as she was swimming towards the surface at that very moment. In all the excitement, I never even wondered what had taken her so long. But sometime later, I asked her. Apparently, when the cabin filled up with water, she saw an orange life jacket that we certainly should have been wearing float by. She saw me open the hatch and swim out and decided to look for the life jackets. When she couldn't locate them, she leisurely decided to surface. Once at the surface, we both started looking for something to hold on to. The storm was still unbelievably strong, and waves were crashing over us constantly. We worked our way along the side of the boat to the stern, where we found a little stainless steel swim ladder sticking straight up into the air. We slipped our arms through, held on for dear life, and actually said, "I love you," to each other. Our survival was actually that unclear at the moment. Well, we hung on in silence from that moment on, probably alarmed by both of us feeling the need to express our love to each other. Within maybe 5 minutes, the fury ended. The water was calm, and the sky began to lighten. We began to assess our situation. The boat was precisely upside down, but floating. We appeared to be not far from where we dropped anchor. We could see the stack of the Anclote power plant on shore about 3 miles away. We swam around the side of the boat and attempted to turn it over. Even though we were in water over our heads, it should have been easy with all that weight in the keel. It wouldn't budge. I managed to reach up and grab onto the keel and pull myself up onto the bottom of the boat. Even my body weight added to the keel wouldn't pull it around. Dumbfounded, I began to try and rock it back and forth, and then suddenly, it decided to roll over. As it came around, the sight was sickening. An 8-foot piece of the mast was still attached to the twisted steel mast step. It laid flat on the cabin top, the shrouds and stays led over the side and into the water. The boat was filled right up to the rails of the cockpit, but she was floating. The Hutchins folks, manufacturers of the Compact 16, had refused to guarantee she would float if flooded, but she sure was doing it. I climbed on board and fished around into the open rear hatch, the one we forgot to secure, for the hand pump that normally was stashed there. What were the odds that it would still be there? Well, it was right there, where it belonged. I have no idea why. I pumped for a few minutes, but it was clear I couldn't compete with the waves that came over the rails more quickly than I could pump. It was clear that we could not refloat her. So there we sat, me in the flooded cockpit and Roz hanging on the side. As luck would have it, within a few minutes, a powerboat approached us. They had sought shelter from the same storm by beaching themselves on Anclote Key. They had seen us anchor before the storm and had come out looking for us. They radioed a commercial towing service, and the rest, as they say, is history. If you look in the archives of the St. Petersburg Times for July 12, 1992, you will find articles about the waterspout, aka tornado, that traveled up the intercoastal waterway from Clearwater, wrecking dozens of boats along the way. Our boat sustained approximately $1,400 damage. The mast had snapped in half cleanly, like a peppermint stick. No bend, just a clean break. Miraculously, the motor, which had been submerged in salt water for hours, after being flushed with motor oil, ran better than it ever had before. In fact, it is still running today, 13 years later, on the same boat. The repaired Sloop du Jour is now owned and frequently sailed by my daughter and her husband.
Just a dream of the wind that carries you soon.
So there you have it, another edition of Radio Free Radio's Digital Flotsam. Detailed information about all the great music you heard in the background can be found in the Digital Flotsam show notes. And of course, in case you may have forgotten,
Peter, hold the microphone.